The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning, everyone. We're just a little bit behind here this morning. Hope everybody's having a great morning. Oops. Hey, have you ever wondered where your tax money for your gasoline goes when you go and fill up at the pump? I think you'd be surprised. Well, you're probably not surprised because you know it's not going to fixing our roads.
But, we've got
the down low on that for you today. And what else we got, Aaron?
We're talking about the Oakland VA in the second hour. So for all those people that know darn well that the Veterans Administration is going sideways, we lost another veteran the other day, pushed themselves in front of a train. It's just a travesty, and I think we all know that. Well, we're going to get a little window in what it's like to work at the Oakland VA, so that ought to be kind of interesting. You're listening to We the People Radio. It seems to be a little bit different beginning every week, but We the People Radio, we also broadcast online at wethepeopleradio.us, because Bill's computer sound is still on. just one more thing we enjoy. If you want to call in, number's 530-605-4567. You're joining Aaron, Bill, and Bob this morning for the 2 hours from 8 to 10. Actually, in all of our archives are managed by Robert Exter, and big thanks to him. He takes care of the webpage at wethepeopleradio.us. And so as soon as the show is finished, the archive pops on in about an hour or so, and if you send someone that page, they can get all the information. We always include articles and video and whatever our guests send us, so that anything we refer to during the show, you can look back on and do your own research. We don't want you to just take our word for stuff. So anyway, that's our auspicious beginning.
Yeah, I think we've got a great show lined up.
I think we do, too. I think we kind of have two. We're going to somehow cram them both into 2 hours.
As usual, we're going to give you something to pray for when you go to church today.
That's actually probably true, too. So do we have Lawrence McQuillan in there?
Dr. McQuillan is standing by.
We do, and I chatted with him before we got started, and he said he likes to be called Lawrence. So instead of, was it last week when it was like, doctor? We had like four scientists on, and all we said was doctor the whole day. It was funny.
You think we have problems.
I know, really. If that's the biggest challenge we face, I guess.
Our Saturday show on Casey and I are positively healthy.
Yeah.
Now we have identical twins co-hosting. Dr. Maria
identical twin?
She has an identical twin, yes. She
sounds like.
Sorry.
She has drafted her identical twin into co-hosting the show. So.
Oh.
The only thing is, when you're listening to them, it's impossible to tell them apart.
Oh my gosh. Do they look the same?
I did not actually see
part, I think.
Just listening yesterday.
You don't know.
You never know.
You don't know. Maybe it's not.
Do you have an identical twin?
No. But I have four siblings, and we all sound the same, so I guess it doesn't matter.
I have an imaginary friend.
I knew somebody was going somewhere bad. Okay, let's go back to Dr. Lawrence McQuillan. All right, he's a senior. I'm going to kind of, there's a lot of biography on here, and I hope people do go look, because, you know, a lot of times when people speak about things on the radio, they say, oh, well, what does this guy know? You know, I read blah, blah, blah in the paper, or the Wall Street Journal, or, oh, how about our Uber source, New York Times, because they've done such good research lately.
That's the first place I go.
So just, you know, make sure we're all credentialed up here. So Lawrence McQuillan is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Entrepreneurial Innovation at the Independent Institute. He received his PhD in economics from George Mason University. That might sound familiar because we have Dr. Paul Hauser that deals with the Klamath Dams that's at George Mason. He has served as chief economist at the Illinois Policy Institute, director of business and economic studies at the Pacific Research Institute, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and founding publisher and contributing editor of Economic Issues. He had something other, another interesting, lots of contributions to all sorts of things, including Encyclopedia Britannica, which was fun. But my favorite part, created the California Golden Fleece Award to the highest state or local spending program or regulation that fleeces California taxpayers, consumers, or businesses. I was like, that to me. Then that's the best part of the resume. So, Lawrence, after that kind of psychotic beginning there, where would you like to start on the gas tax and all the other smart growth stuff you have kind of pulled the curtain back on?
Well, good morning. It's great to be with you guys.
Hello. It was fun talking to you on the porch, but it's much better now that we're on the air.
That's right. Well, I stumbled across this just in an informal conversation with somebody, and I thought, wow, this sounds like a really interesting topic that probably a lot of people don't know is happening, and also very dangerous, I think. So in order to understand how all this works, I mean, you really have to follow the money, and every time you go and put a gallon of gas in your gas tank anywhere in the country, you pay 18.4 cents. to the federal government, and that money goes into the Federal Highway Trust Fund. And that trust fund was established all the way back in 1956 to fund the construction and repair of the interstate highway system. And but what happens with most of these government funds is that over time they become slush funds for other things. So that's what's happened with the Highway Trust Fund. And one of the things that's happened is that so-called smart growth advocates have been able to capture part of that fund to promote their, you know, lifestyle choices and political agenda and their vision for what the future of California and the world, in fact, should look like. And the way this goes on is that, well, for example, in July of 2012, the federal government and President Obama signed a bill called the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century Act.
Oh, no.
It has a very lofty-sounding name, but it goes by MAP 21. And what this act did is it set aside $105 billion of the Highway Trust Fund. So this is tax money you paid at the pump that should go into the freeway system. But instead, $105 billion of it is being siphoned out of it and going to fund other programs, especially smart growth programs around the country. And one of the programs is right here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I live, and it's called One Bay Area Grant Program, and it's overseen by the Metropolitan Transportation Commission that kind of handles all the road construction in the San Francisco Bay Area. So $800 million of this, of your tax money that you pay at the pump is going into this One Bay Area grant program. And part of that money then is going to, local governments to purchase land to, set aside more land for what's called, you know, long-term conservation or open space preserves. So essentially when you buy a gallon of gas at any gas station in the United States, you're going to fund partially public local government land purchases in the Bay Area to expand, again, government control of land at the expense of private control of land. And it further restricts, you know, the amount of land that people can use privately for their own objectives, whether it be housing or farmland or commercial or industrial or whatever. But this gives more control than over government land, over land by government rather than private individuals. So it really plays into the whole, you know, smart growth master plan, which is to increasingly have government control over open space. And expand open space and then jam more and more people into a smaller and smaller area along mass transit corridors and what's called stack and pack housing. So it really plays into the whole vision that, you know, the automobile is evil, single family housing is evil, and what we need to do is go towards, you know, cramming everybody into high rise high-density housing along mass transit systems, and we'll all live in peace and harmony together that way.
Well, and meanwhile, we have, you know, I mean, some of our roads are in trouble. You know, some of our roads are looking really shabby. So now,
right.
You know, the president's always yammering about how, oh, we need to build our infrastructure and replace our crumbling infrastructure. That's what they say all the time. Well, that's great, but we've paid the bill. Cool. We've already paid the bill. They're just siphoning it off for their projects. And before we take a break, I just wanted to go back to the Map 21. That popped up for me here a little while ago because, like, I don't know, it's been 6 or 8 months ago, because I had somebody ask me to do some research on why there he's a transit guy. If you buy a car in Idaho or whatever, he'll bring it to you. Or when our co-host moved to Utah, he was going to take their vehicles to them. So he transports vehicles. He's not a huge company. He's a one guy, you know. But his insurance was going up astronomically. And part of that increase was due to the regulation in Map 21. It's not just money being siphoned off for smart growth. You're seeing it. Well, okay, the unseen seeing it. We're gonna watch that in small businesses. So yeah, Bill Miller here in Reading was hit by Map 21. It's like, what is this thing? I started looking at it. It's like, oh God, great.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a monumental federal smart growth thing.
Well, another thing to consider is as they buy up this property, I'm assuming that it's now state-owned property, and being state-owned property, that also takes it off the tax rolls. So I guess the rest of us pick up the difference when that all happens.
Yeah, it depends on how they use it. But yeah, nothing good is coming of this, and bottom line is the money belonged to something else. And on that happy note, we need to take a quick break. We'll be right back in 2 minutes. We will rejoin on smart growth, where your money goes, gas, taxes, and all that jazz. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. The chat room is open. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM. Yeah, that's what I meant.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body.
Classic. All right. Welcome back. You are listening to We the People Radio. We hope you've joined us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us. The chat room is up and running. Looks like we have a handful of people in there chatting away. Sometimes we're on topic, sometimes we're not. So if you can't handle multitasking, the chat room probably isn't your best place.
Well, either way, I guarantee you
it's
we're going to get your blood flowing this morning.
Yeah, it's fun.
It's not for the faint of heart.
No, it isn't. And, you know, So Lawrence, before we forget, actually, you mentioned in your article that this is all part of the Agenda 21 plan, and oftentimes, you know, we have people who tell us that's, you know, I mean, we all know it's not fake, but we get that a lot. So how do you connect the dots on that in your research?
Well, it definitely isn't fake, and what's very ingenious about Agenda 21 is it looks so organic, it looks so locally driven, but in fact, if you look at these smart growth plans all around the world, actually, and I have looked at various plans around the world, they all share the same similar, basically three features, which is, you know, building more high-density residential housing and high-intensity commercial use, mixed use, it's called, along mass transit corridors, and setting aside more open space that's owned and managed by government and off limits to development. So the whole idea is to, you know, cram more and more people into a smaller and smaller area, force them to build up rather than out, do away as much as possible with the automobile and the single-family home with a yard that most people, I think, still consider the American dream, and then force this vision on everybody through government edicts and plans. And it really looks the same all around the world. It is remarkable. But people see this as coming from their own local government or regional government. And so it looks very, very locally driven and what the people want, but it's really being imposed in a large extent from the outside because these people kind of share the same vision about what the future should look like and, you know, the evils of the automobile and the benefits of us all living along mass transit and taking mass transit, whether we want to or not. And so now they're really controlling the levers in terms of how many roads are being built, where the roads are being built, if the roads are being built or repaired at all, if you can make the roads basically unusable through not maintaining them, of course, people aren't going to be able to drive long distances, or they're going to be, you know, it's going to be so inconvenient that they're going to want to live closer and closer to where they work. And so you can control this. If you can control the land and the roads, you can kind of control the ultimate outcome. And this is what they're doing successfully, especially in the Bay Area, where this has probably been further carried along than any place else any place else in the United States and maybe even the world.
And the people in the Bay Area really, I can't generalize, but a large number of people in the Bay Area have no clue that this is happening.
They don't, no. Again, because it looks so organic, you know, it looks so locally inspired that they don't realize this is part of a bigger vision of what the future should look like. Thankfully, I mean, in the nine-county region of the San Francisco Bay Area, I mean, there are groups in every one of these counties who are pushing back. I mean, some are more organized than others. Some are more successful than others. But they weren't able to kill the master plan, which was passed in July of this year, this summer. The Association of Bay Area Governments and the Metropolitan Transportation Commission in July passed what's called Plan Bay Area, which is basically a master plan for the development of housing and transportation going forward over the next 40 years. And, you know, they've actually determined on a map, you know, where development can happen, where it can't, where do we want to buy more land up. So this whole Highway Trust Fund program that's being used to buy up land, I mean, they know where they're going to do this. And it's already, there's circles on a map that show where they're going to do this and where they're going to expand, you know, open space at the expense of private land purchases or private land ownership. So it's very developed here in the Bay Area in terms of how far along this has gone. But thankfully, I mean, there's multiple lawsuits against it right now, and hopefully some of them will be successful at stopping this.
Well, part of your article that kind of made my hair stand up, or there were three articles, actually, we should help people with that. One's called Highway Robbery, How Your Taxes Subsidize the California Lifestyle. And that isn't just California gas tax, by the way. Plan Bay Area, Smart Growth and Sustainable Communities Hurt the Poor. That was huge. I want to make sure we make sure and hit that. And then SB1, Why Senator Steinberg's SB1 Deserves Defeat or a Veto. These plans, and it kind of moves into that idea of how it hurts the poor and the disadvantaged, because when you start looking at these sweeping developments, they're looking at piling the next, 2 million people. They expect the Bay Area to grow from 7 to 9 million people, and they expect those 2 million people to fit into 5%. Of the area. I'm like, well, that doesn't really work out.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Under that master plan I talked about, Plan Bay Area, the requirement is that the additional 2 million people that are going to move into the Bay Area over the next 40 years are going to have to be housed within just 5% of the land in the Bay Area. So, of course, I mean, that's going to require more stack-and-pack housing along mass transit, which is their vision. But these areas that they've, you know, prioritized for development, they're called priority development areas, and they have a kind of a fancy name for them. But they're, almost all of them are located, or the vast majority of them are located in areas of the Bay Area that are populated by the poor, minorities, disadvantaged, seniors. So they're really targeting the poor to take their land from them. And they claim, well, we'll find another place in the Bay Area for them to live. Well, right. I mean, they probably live in these areas because they're affordable and they're close to their loved ones. They're close to support networks. They're close to where the jobs are. So they've chosen these areas for a reason. And yet now they're going to be targeted under Plan Bay Area to be basically, you know, removed from their neighborhoods and resettled somewhere else. And it's just a really dangerous idea that, you know, it almost sounds like, you know, internment camps of the past, where you're just human settlements you're creating and you're moving people around against their will. And, of course, you know, they'll use eminent domain if they need to take the land where these people are living right now and take the buildings so that they can build these new high-rise units in these so-called priority development areas. So it really is a plan that's at war with the poor when you look at it. I mean, they're really targeting the areas where these people live, and their claim, I think, is completely unbelievable that they're going to create other areas in the Bay Area where these people can be housed because, you know, when is the last time, you know, the housing has ever been adequate for low-income people in the Bay Area?
I mean, sure.
It's really an area where, you know, the wealthy can afford market-rate housing and the poor always struggle. And, you know, they've managed to carve out various areas around, you know, Oakland and the western part of San Francisco that are less expensive. But now these are exactly the areas that Pine Bay Area is targeting for future development.
And if they don't take, the thing in your article that was kind of important is that even if they don't take the land by eminent domain, because I always in the back of my mind, you know, I hear the other team, you know, well, we're not going to take their land. Well, if they don't take it, as you rightly point out, the land prices and rents will increase, pushing out tens of thousands of poor and elderly residents. So,
right. In effect,
they're being resettled whether they take their land or they just drive the rent up to a point where they can't live there anymore.
Well, yeah, but
right, yeah, exactly. And it's going to be funded, again, through, you know, a lot of tax dollars that are being funneled to this program. So it's not like private developers are buying this land on their own. I mean, this is going to be highly subsidized, purchases of land that is being financed, as I mentioned, largely by, federal highway taxes, believe it or not, are going to fund this movement of people, poor people, out of, you know, places where they've lived for, in some cases, you know, generations. And the interesting thing, too, is that, that I think so much of these projects they're going to crowd people, you know, into a smaller and smaller area and make life, you know, more difficult, more miserable for, you know, poor people that have managed, you know, to carve out in areas of the city where, you know, they feel comfortable and, you know, it is affordable for them. And now they're going to be displaced and scattered, you know, all throughout the Bay Area. And I think it's going to be unlikely that they're going to be able to afford these new units that they claim are going to be built for them.
To add to that, if they're already living in the cheapest place they can find, but they'll end up moving further away from their support groups and their jobs and so forth. And then on top of that, they want to add this vehicle mileage tax. So, you know, the more you drive, the more you pay. So, you know, what's mm-hmm. the, you know, what's the outcome of that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to your credit, San Francisco Bay Area progressives, I mean, a lot of the people on the left really did fight Plan Bay Area, and they really thought that this is really disproportionately harmful for the poor and minorities in the area, and that what we need is a plan that will disperse, future housing around the area more than concentrating just 5% of the land. So there's a lot of sympathy to fighting the smart growth, even within groups on the left.
Who's pushing it then?
How crazy these plans have gotten.
Who's pushing it then, Lawrence? If the left is fighting it, because I know that the conservative groups on the right were fighting it.
Right. Well, it's not all the left. I think it's mainly more of the left people who are sympathetic towards, you know, the poor and minorities, in particular.
I think a lot of them.
But the people who are pushing it, I mean, a lot of times it's, you know, local government officials, because they see this as, you know, greater power for them, which it is. And they can create, under SB1, they'd be able to create these sustainable communities investment authorities, which is really just the old redevelopment agencies on steroids. And they could appoint members to these authorities. So they would have much more, you know, power, local government officials. And then also all the politically connected developers, too, are for this, because they're going to get the land and they're going to get the contracts to build these new high-rise developments in this, you know, 5% of the land, and they're going to get subsidized from the federal government and the state government to do it. So there's a lot of, you know, very wealthy developers who are privately or very well-connected, powerfully situated people who are for this too and are pushing this. And then it's, you know, people that agree with the Agenda 21 vision. And there's a lot of them who really just see, you know, the automobile as destroying the climate, and we need to do something about it because of global warming. And so this is what they've, you know, devised, is this plan to get people out of their car and using mass transit, and supposedly, you know, saving the climate in the process.
And, of course, we learned last week when we played, you know, Doctor, we had all the scientists on, that, let's see, the amount of air pollution you breathe in California over a 70-year period is lower than the particulate matter you inhale from one cigarette. So less than one cigarette of particulate matter over a 70-year period, and that's, I mean, with things as horrible as they are now. So it's like, you know. Okay, we've got to take one more break here. But
does that include medical marijuana cigarettes?
Oh, man. Yeah, don't even get me started on that one.
Truly conflicted over that one.
Yeah, I want to make our population smarter and more motivated, huh? What a good idea. I really like the end of the conclusion of the highway robbery article. I thought that was just priceless. Here, Lawrence's conclusion here. Next time you hit one of those freeway potholes, be reminded that the money you paid at the pump to maintain our highways is being used to purchase land in Napa Valley so wine snobs can ride their $5,000 mountain bikes. That's how smart growth really works. And I think that's when Sally read that article and said, you got to have this guy on the radio.
They got some really nice bike lanes, though. I mean, those, they've got a bang-up job on those.
We're going to take 2 minutes, and we're going to clobber Bill with our coffee cups here, and we'll be right back with Dr. Lawrence McQuillan. We're talking about who's paying for smart growth. It's you, by the way.
Yeah, I think we all know the answer to that one.
Oh, fun song. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in.
Yeah, the day we look for San Francisco for being saved, we're in big, big, big trouble.
Big trouble. So we're here with Dr. Lawrence McQuillan, who has written three terrific articles. I had somebody in the chat room ask where they could find those. Go to wethepeopleradio.us, and all three of them are posted, actually, down right underneath his bio. So, Highway Robbery, How Your Taxes Subsidize the California Lifestyle, Plan Bay Area, Smart Growth and Sustainable Communities Hurt the Poor, and Why Senator Steinberg's SB1 Deserves Defeat. So that's, I think that's the piece that we haven't really connected, if that's okay with you, Lawrence, is SB1.
It is, yeah.
Can you give people kind of a rundown on where it is? And for those of us who didn't follow it when it was bubbling up the first time, how likely is it and what's it going to do?
Well, I think that one's going to hit them right in the pocketbook, and I think that's going to get people involved if it ever did come to fruition. But if it did, we're just
it'll
doomed.
Be sneaky.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, the way to think about Senator Steinberg's SB1 is that it's basically the financing mechanism for smart growth in California. So it's where the money's going to come from. And this bill is still in play. It was put in the inactive file at the very end of last year, but it can be recalled now any time when the legislature starts, well, tomorrow. I mean, it could be recalled tomorrow. And all it requires now is another vote, and it can go right to Governor Brown's desk. So it's really close to getting through the legislature. And I think this is actually one of the most dangerous bills in the history of the state of California,
absolutely.
Especially for property rights. Because what it would do, it would allow any city or county in California to establish what's called a Sustainable Communities Investment Authority. And what these authorities can do is establish development projects within certain geographic areas of this authority. And they can take land without making any kind of blight determination. So under the old redevelopment agencies that Governor Brown was very much opposed to, at least they had to make a separate blight determination to take land. But even with that, there was rampant property rights abuses. But under this new bill, they don't even have to make that determination. They just have to say, we want to build this project because it will reduce energy consumption or relieve traffic congestion or reduce water consumption. And it just has to reduce what's called statewide blight. So now blight is defined at a statewide level rather than like a very local community level.
Wow.
So they just have to say, this project is going to reduce traffic congestion and thereby reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so we want to take this land to build this high-rise along this BART route, the Bay Area Rapid Transit Subway System.
And Lawrence,
and they can do it then. They can just take the land then without any separate blight determination and then build this project. And also these authorities, they can issue bonds to build these developments without voter approval. They can increase sales taxes within these geographic areas. They can increase or extract property taxes in these geographic areas. So they have just unlimited, unprecedented authority to take land and impose new taxes. I mean, this is an incredibly dangerous bill,
Lawrence,
that threatens every property owner in California.
Yeah. And now say again, who actually establishes or has the authority to form these authorities? Who would do that?
City councils or county board of supervisors.
Board of supervisors.
Or jointly, cities. A city and a county could work together to form one.
And so they would form these authorities and appoint the people on these authorities. They're not elected, and then those folks will basically have the power to implement however they see fit.
They wave the magic wand. I'd like to hear.
Yeah, they're unelected officials that would be on these authorities, and they could build projects, take land, increase sales taxes, extract property taxes from police and fire, for example, divert it over to pay off, the bonds that they can issue without voter approval to build these projects.
Yeah.
And they're little kingdoms that are going to be created.
And
little kingdoms is exactly it.
Yeah, and that's like the final solution right there. I mean, once they get going, you've got no power to stop that.
Well, I like this part here. You have 25% of the tax increment revenue in a project area must be used for affordable housing units. Well, I mean, just from what we're seeing, like in New York with the affordable housing units that they're making there, 250
square
foot family housing.
Right.
Like, oh, it's going to be awesome. Or not.
Yeah. It's incredibly dangerous. Like I said, it's kind of sitting there dormant, but it could be reactivated at any time. And Steinberg, you know, is president pro tem of the Senate, so he's, you know, very powerful. This is fortunately his last year in office, so he's turned out.
He'll just get a new crazy person. It won't be a problem.
And the governor has been very much against redevelopment agencies. As you know, he's a former mayor of Oakland. He's seen these things firsthand. He's not a fan. He thinks these things really don't work in terms of spurring investment and new development. So hopefully, if it did reach his desk, he would veto it. I'm hopeful that he would, because he does understand that these redevelopment agencies, they don't work, and they just are political land grabs and political power plays to help, you know, friends and punish enemies. I mean, the money goes just very politically connected developers is really all it does. And it actually reduces the amount of affordable housing studies show over time. So it doesn't do anything to really help the poor.
Of course.
And the governor, thankfully, he does understand this. So I'm hopeful that if this does get through the legislature, it will be vetoed. But it is dangerous, and you can rest assured that this is going to come up again, even if it, you know, gets defeated this time. Because this is part of how they plan on financing their smart growth vision for the future. And they're not going to rest. I mean, there's too many people who believe in this vision of stack and pack, and they're not going to stop until they, you know, get something like this passed.
So, Lawrence, at the end of your article there, you said that SB1 was killed in the Senate, but it sounds like it's on hold. And what are they doing? Rewriting it so that it could possibly get through the Senate to the governor's desk?
Lurking.
I mean, is it really dead or not?
It died because it was moved to the inactive file, but I don't think it's going to be modified at all. I think that Steinberg saw that he probably didn't have the governor's support, and so he is going to bring it back, I think, in his last term in office, I mean, his last year, Steinberg's last year in office. So I think he's going to try to bring it back and see if he can get it through, you know, past the governor somehow, through probably, you know, wheeling and dealing. You know, if you sign this bill, we'll do something that you really want. And that's, you know, log rolling is how legislators work. So,
are we seeing this nutty
not
stuff?
I don't think it's going to be changed at all. I think it's just kind of dormant. It's kind of sitting there like a virus, and it's going to spring forward eventually sometime in 2014. The hope is that the governor will just do the right thing and veto it.
Well, do we see this other places, like around the country? I don't know how much, how wide your search was, but are there other places doing this stuff? Has anybody passed anything like this?
No, not this draconian. I mean, this is by far the most highly developed idea in terms of, you know, integrating the tax funding through the Highway Trust Fund with Plan Bay Area, and then putting on top of this, overlaying on all of this, SB1, which will finance the whole thing. It's very well integrated, although it looks from afar, you know, people don't really pay attention. It looks like a three separate or four separate bills, but they're all actually tied together in this grand vision. But now, as far as I know, I mean, San Francisco Bay Area is by far, you know, the most advanced in going down this path. There is right now a big debate in South Florida. It's called 750. It's seven counties in South Florida, right around the Miami-Dade area. And it's a 50-year plan, so that's why they call it 750, seven counties, 50 years. So it would be very similar to Palm Bay area here. But there are three counties of the seven have already backed out of the plan, and they don't have the support. So it's starting to crumble.
Yay.
And basically due to really a lot of grassroots support, grassroots opposition there. I mean, they seem to be a little bit better organized there than we were here in California. So they're having more success about pushing it back, and so far it hasn't passed. But it would be very similar to what did pass here in the Bay Area. But again, as I mentioned, I mean, there's like three or four lawsuits ongoing right now So the hope is that, you know, Plan Bay Area can be declared unconstitutional for property rights violations going forward. There's some really good groups that are heading up the legal fight against it. So, you know, fingers crossed, governor will veto SB1 and Plan Bay Area will go down and defeat as unconstitutional. I mean, that's the best thing that could come of this, but I think we all need to be vigilant because this is something that's not going to go away. They're going to try to bring this back even if they lose today.
Well, Lawrence, I think that like anything else, these bills will only pass if people don't pay attention. And I think once people realize how hard this is going to hit them in the pocketbook, that's when they're going to get active, and that's when they're going to start speaking out on it. Until you clip them with money, people don't care.
Yeah, well, you're right. And this is just the beginning. And they're going to see the property taxes going to, you know, this sustainable development, not for, you know, things that they want, which is roads, police, fire, parks, libraries. The money's going to be going and siphoned off for sustainable communities and smart growth. And I think when people's, you know, sales taxes go up and property taxes get diverted, they're going to be wise to what's really going on here, which is, you know, basically a redistribution project to politically connected people. I mean, that's how it's going to work.
And that's how it works in all the other corrupt countries that do stuff like this. And people say, oh, we should be like Europe. I mean, they've got such a great model. Well, this is kind of what it looks like. You know, and as far as the federal highway funds go, so now when we keep hearing, you know, the White House talk about how we need to build our infrastructure, blah, 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 you know, I hope our listeners hear we should stop siphoning off the money that's actually being paid to do that.
Yeah, there's plenty of money there to fix the roads if they'd use it
to
fix the roads.
And that's what we all knew, too. I mean, we've all known that the money's there. It was just fun to... It was fun that you did the research. We thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
So we're in our last minute. Can you believe it? We're actually going to end better than we started. How's that? We started off a little chaotic. We're actually going to conclude properly. We want to thank you for coming on. We're going to need you to come on again.
Yes.
So please save.
I would love to.
Save our number and all that, and I'm sure you've written all sorts of other fun things. Shoot me emails on possible ideas for shows because we love having folks that have done research smarten us all up. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Lawrence J. McQuillan, PhD. It was fantastic. We learned all about smart growth and how expensive it's going to be. Ew. So thanks, Dr. McQuillan. We'll let you go have your Sunday. We're coming back. We're going to talk about the Oakland Veterans Administration. Ew. More yuckiness. We're here at We the People Radio, KCNR, 1460 AM, Shasta Redding.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hour two, straight ahead, here at KCNR, Shasta Redding.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Start talking.
Oh, yep, I was just dreaming about that Green Bay game today at
and how you wish you could be sitting in the stands.
I got shivers down my back. Boy, that'd be a good one to go sit in the stands and watch, wouldn't it?
I think it's the forecast is for 2 below 0 with the windshield making it feel like 40 below or something like that.
Oh, lovely. But the turf is heated, so it won't be bad.
Well, you know, if you were the cleanup guy, though, that'd be kind of great because nobody would be loitering around after. You know, people go to the game probably and I don't know, after you sat there all that time, maybe you do loiter.
Yeah, I don't know. What do frozen hot dogs taste like, though?
Yeah, exactly.
Passing out free coffee and hot chocolate to the fans that actually show up.
Wouldn't that be just wild? God. But, you know, I mean, I don't know. I grew up in the snow, and when you live in the cold, you kind of, I don't know, cold's cold.
And the Niners finished with a much better record than Green Bay, but Green Bay got the home field because Green Bay won their division, and the Niners are a wild card. They may want to look at changing that rule, because you can make a case for the Niners should have That they should have had a home field advantage today, but those are the rules.
They're going to learn about coldness.
Yeah, they're definitely going to learn about coldness. That's just crazy cold.
So, now that, our first hour, you're joining We the People Radio, just so we kind of close that loop there. Okay. If you would like to call us, the number is 530-605-4567. Everything you want to know about the program is actually online, thanks to Robert Exter, who puts up a terrific page. He just absolutely laid things out great today, too. We have two different guests today. So the first hour, we were talking to Dr. Lawrence McQuillan about the topic of smart growth and who pays for it. You, by the way, is the answer to that, the short answer. So if you'd like to learn more about that, listen to the archive here that'll be up shortly. This second hour, we're joining Anthony Silveria down in the Bay Area. It's funny. We were just talking about the Bay Area. Anthony down there, he has worked at the Oakland VA. I'm not going to give you his whole resume because it's long, but it is online, so I think you should go look at it. I'm just going to give you the highlights that I thought were highlights. I get to pick my own highlights. He is a former Marine, military police, disabled veteran, and he is an employee of the Oakland VA that was removed from employment by the director for reporting harassment, discrimination based on disability, increased surveillance, and a hostile work environment.
Oh, that can't be true. All that?
Yeah.
In one place?
Yeah, and you know, and they're processing record number of claims down there. Oh, no, wait. No, they're not. He has filed under the Whistleblower Act and the No Fear Act for not protecting disabled veterans from harassment. And just some of his, he was in the Marine Corps from 1990 to 1999. He was military police in K-9 with military working dogs. He was Special Weapons Assault Team, Accident Investigator, Department of Defense, and an instructor and manager of the Military Working Dog Kennels. Received a Joint Service Commendation Medal, Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medals, whole bunch of other recognitions that I won't actually read here. He's Marine of the Year. This totally sounds like a guy who's going to be a problem employee, I guess is my point in including this. He provided personal protection for the Presidents of the United States, President Bush Sr., President Clinton, Vice President Gore, and other foreign and domestic dignitaries. The was not actually in the resume. I just threw that in.
I heard that.
Yeah, the was just free. He had first place overall top dog in the military working dogs there. He was a top honor graduate in the Sergeant's Leadership Course. He was stationed in Hawaii. Kind of fun on Oahu there. And lots of awards with the Department of Veterans Affairs for performance. And God knows we could use some people getting awards for performance in Oakland.
Well, he had a, yeah.
For like real performance.
Get an award for working more than 5 minutes in that place.
Yeah, there's that too. That'll be the award we'll give him.
Yeah.
So, anyway, things have gone south, I guess we'll say, for Tony. And so even though he was out on medical disability, they felt the need to fire him, which of course doesn't work out. But he's willing to speak out on all these issues that are going on in Oakland. I'm sure it's not the only Veterans Administration office that's having problems, but it is, wherever you live in the country, it's bottom rung on the ladder or bottom two and has been for a very long time. His window into what's going on there gives us a good idea of why the performance is so low and why the output is the way it is. And just on a local note, we had another veteran waiting for benefits, Vietnam-era veteran, amputee, who pushed himself in front of a train a couple nights ago. Had made comments to other veterans in the local area, which is how I found out about it. He said that, you know, Sarge decided not to wait anymore for his benefits. Repeatedly denied, had the big sores from Agent Orange exposure, and yet the Oakland VA continued to deny him. So, oh, that was kind of a long lead in there. But do we have Tony in the?
I want to thank Tony for speaking out. I mean, we need a lot more people to speak out on this. It's so out of control down there, and people are scared to death that they're going to be on the street if they open their mouth. So thank you very much, Tony.
No problem. I've been trying to work the internal channels for a couple of years, and it's not working out. OIG, I can give you all kinds of acronyms, but you can look them up on the website.
Yeah. So the Office of Inspector General. We always have to kind of assume that people people might not speak government. So we're not going to, you know, drill out all the acronyms the whole show. But at the beginning of each one, we'll try not to speak in code. Yeah, so yeah. So what do you think, Tony? At the end of the day, what's the percentage of veterans that actually work in the Oakland VA ballpark?
Oh, I know we have a lot less now. I'm assuming it's less than 40%, easy, maybe 30%.
Okay. And in management, what's our veteran population?
There is one person that was in Vietnam era for 2 or 3 years, and he was an assistant coach. And then the other person is my current supervisor, who he was in the reserves for a while as a Mustang officer, but he doesn't seem like he's ever been in the military.
And so as far as, like, the director and all those folks, zip military experience.
He said he was in the Navy, but I've never seen any kind of code of ethics from him, like, any type, integrity, any of that.
Huh. Yeah, and that kind of counts. Should count. So you worked at the VA, I think you told me, 2009 you went to work there?
Yeah, I actually went out on disability for another organization, a civilian organization, and then got released, and I didn't know I can pursue the claim. I got picked up on voc rehab, and then voc rehab, vocational rehabilitation, they allowed me to apply for a position at the VA in 2009, and I applied as a claims assistant, which is where you start processing mail, and you get a lot of work. I mean, gosh, all kinds of stuff with a claims assistant. You're the first part of the processing.
Okay, and you're a disabled veteran, so
no, you're 100%. I got several surgeries and a lot of different conditions that have been exacerbated by the Oakland Regional Office.
Imagine that little stress on the job causing some problems there.
Mainly, it's undue stress. Like you were speaking about, I was in law enforcement. I never had problems with stress until you get to a place where you're helpless and nobody's coming out, nothing's happening the way it's supposed to. They're not following the laws, rules, and regulations when you provide them to them, and then they want to speak about it. I've requested what we call ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution, with Douglas Bragg and a bunch of other managers there at the office, and I've been ignored. Not denied, just ignored. And there's supposed to be a VA Form 0889 provided to somebody when they are denied ADR. And I've asked for that since September 2012, and I still haven't had it.
Wow.
The rules don't apply. That's
yeah, so who cares, huh?
That's their MO down there.
When you first went there, just out of curiosity, because, you know, how we, you know, we've all had different jobs, right? And some of them started out good and ended bad and vice versa. When you, you know, so I don't mean to presume. When you first went there, what was your impression?
Well, actually, I got to tell you, I went there and I wanted to apply to the VA. Several times I tried for a VSR position, but I got passed over.
And that is a what? What's a VSR?
A Veterans Service Representative. It's the person that does developing on claims and stuff like that. You have to usually have a bachelor's degree and some type of GPA. I met all the requirements for it, but I just kept getting passed over until I got that vocational rehabilitation preference. But I wanted to work with the VA because since I got out in 99, my claim has been royally screwed up at the Oakland Regional Office, Reno Office, Phoenix Office, so bad that I had to actually work at the VA to understand where the problems were. I never understood how bad it was until I got there, and I just realized it's so much common sense, but they don't, I think somebody said the rules don't apply. You see that sometimes, you're like, how does it not apply? It's a law. U.S. Code, Code of Federal Regulation, come on now.
Yeah, and so when, because I've spoken to other people there, and so when they break the rules, if you bring it up, you wind up cleaning toilets in Martinez.
It gets even worse than that, because if you don't stop talking, then there's other things. They just keep coming after you. I had supervisors follow me around. They'd interrupt me in my conversations, tell me I have to get back to work. Even if it's like a minute, a professional conversation, you got to stop talking, get back to work. And then there would be, I got followed around, told I couldn't go on break. I had third-party witnesses come forward for the EEO investigation to explain this. I brought this up to my supervisor. My doctor said, unquestionably related to hostile work environment. Brought that to him, too. They ignored it. They didn't want to talk about it.
And so there are investigations pending, and you're going to have to decipher that for folks.
Well, the EEO investigation has been pending for, I've signed 2 extensions, and I'm still waiting for the administrative judge to go over 2,000 pages of investigative notes. But I'm not going to go into detail because of confidentiality and whatnot, but seriously, 2,000 pages of investigative notes, over 20 witnesses, unbelievable.
And that's not enough to make a case.
And that's equal. That's a yeah. And an EEO investigation involves. Is that state? Is it
involved? Everything that you named off, the discrimination based on disability is what started it. I reported it more than once. I dropped it for the first claim in June 2012 after that June 2012 training we had to go to. And then I just let it go because the people started following me around and my job started getting really bad. And at that time, that was the last exceptional performance award I ever got. And then at that point, they just started coming after me, following me around, making my life worse. My disabilities got so bad I couldn't even function at work. My doctor pulled me off of work. They denied my workman's comp claim. They wouldn't pay me while I was out. I had to fight to get the money back. When I finally got the money back, the Department of Labor still has claims pending. They started recouping money. They recouped like several months. I had to get a judge involved to stop the recoupment. It's unbelievable. It's not efficiency of service at all. It's actually the exact opposite.
And you see the same stuff with veterans' claims.
Well, the thing is that when you have all your employees trying to tell the managers you're doing the wrong thing, you're not following the laws, rules, and regulations, they should be working claims. The managers should know these things. They should know that these things are entitlements and rights of the employees. Why are you harassing your employees? You want them to be working. You want them to be happy. You want to increase morale, not decrease it by telling them or bullying them around. Like when I got escorted out, they didn't have to escort me out for AWOL. What they could have done is said, all right, you can go to your union rep like I requested, but they wanted to walk them through the office to intimidate everybody. They even say it in my release, in my evidence file, that they wanted to make sure this doesn't happen again. Really? Really?
And that was because you were out on disability, but they claimed, let's connect that back for people.
Oh, I'll connect the dots for you. I went out on FMLA again because
Go back. You just lost us again. The FMLA.
Sorry. Workman's compensation, I was out in December of 2012 and beginning of January. All that stuff happened, I explained earlier, but then my disabilities got better and I was able to go back to work, and my financial reasons, I had to go back to work. But when it came back to like June and July, they were writing me up, giving me admonishments, not allowing me to get anything. They were writing me counseling statements, just pretty much setting me up to fire me, and they got really bad. My doctor pulled me off work again, put me on FMLA, which is Federal Medical Leave Act, or Family Medical Leave Act. While I was out, I received over 20 letters. I was suspended for 3 days by the director, proposed suspensions. They told me that I had a return to work order. Well, I was out for my doctor's orders, even though I needed medical convalescence, I had to come back into work and request permission on some special form for me to be out sick.
Wow.
I feel bad if somebody's in the hospital, you know, I'm trying to get them in.
Yeah, you're in a car accident or something. And
yeah, just wheel the gurney up the elevator.
Yeah,
there.
We're sorry, but you can't do that from here.
Oh, but I do got to say, I've heard the management going to, somebody had an anxiety breakdown, and they went to the hospital to get them to sign the form.
You're kidding.
No, actually, I'm not.
And you guys are actually a union deal, which usually is a bad thing, but in your case, it seems like it's a good thing, but they're not actually helping.
No, because the union, I guess, the people that are in there and the president and stuff like that, they worked with Mr. Bragg before when he was at the Oakland Regional Office as a VSR, so they have some history. And everything I've tried to do, I was met with negative results as far as the union. They didn't even want to represent me at some point, which is, of course, failure to duty representation. So I reported that stuff to the Federal Labor Relations Authority for all of these kind of charges, and that's still pending investigation over a year. But other things are starting to come out about finances and things I can't talk about, but the Department of Labor has taken on a huge investigation, several investigations, which are still pending. But, again, I get no whistleblower protection and no fear.
Isn't the president of that union under investigation for some type of embezzlement at this time?
That's where it all stems. That's where it all stems. Yeah, the gossip is there's some embezzlement going on. They're not managing funds correctly. They're not reporting statements properly. And there's a lot of stuff that's there that I don't even know about. It's just things that I've heard. But whenever the investigative report comes out, I'd be curious.
Yeah, no kidding. Hold that thought. We better put our break in here. We'll have them all at the same time. We'll have one non-ending advertisement. So we've got to thank our advertisers. You are joining us here at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Lots of information online at the webpage there. Listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
So many lies twisted my heart was truly wasted.
Definitely fight the powers that be. Oakland is so out of hand down there. I guess a little more privileged than most. I get to hear a little bit more of the inside stuff that goes on down there, and it blows my mind to hear some of the stories that go on in that place. It's
you should try living it. It's pretty crazy. It's like being in Alice in Wonderland. You know things are one way, but then when you go to work, it's a total different way. And I feel bad for the employees working.
Yeah,
they have some amazing employees, but wow, Alice in Wonderland all the way.
Yeah, and the thing is they don't even try to hide it. It's right out in the open for people to look at. And
yeah, people, they can do what they want. They already said they can do what they want.
Well,
so any of the rules how they want.
It's intimidation in the first degree down there.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
And then the product, this is the part that blows me away. It's one thing if, because most of the time when you hear about this kind of thing, everybody thinks that they're doing a great job. And people are going, oh, that couldn't be happening. But amazingly enough, they are at the bottom or next to the bottom of all 58. Just to kind of explain this, we had some confusion in the chat room, and I realized I didn't do a very good job at the beginning of explaining what we're talking about. There are 58 regional offices. So you hear them called VARO, Veterans Association Regional Offices. There are 58 of them across the country, and they are not the hospitals. They don't do all that stuff. It is literally the federal regional office that approves benefits. So when it might be a Vietnam-era veteran who's applying now for benefits for things that happened, or it might be somebody who served in Desert Storm. All different veterans of different eras apply. And then there are cases like some of them that are 35, 38, 39 years old, people who applied for benefits and have been repeatedly stalled, claim lost, claim denied, dragged on, blah, blah, blah. That stuff happens for the folks in Northern California and actually Central California, too. The only other offices in California are in San Diego and L.A. So everybody else is processed out of Oakland. So, you know, most people think that everybody down there is making a bunch of big money and being irresponsible. But what we're learning is there are a lot of good people trying to do their jobs who are being prevented. So, kind of...
trying to do the right thing.
They're kind of put that back in perspective.
Every time they report that, absolutely. Great employees down there. And, in fact, that's why we went to that June training in 2012. We were forced to go away from our work. We closed down the Oakland Regional Office. You can pull up all the news reports on that. And it was unsatisfactory. 10-hour days, not getting compensated, bussed over to San Francisco. And the training was... it was good to a point, but when we got back, everything went back to the way it was. So nothing really mattered. We were forced to do that for a show of political, hey, we'll take care of it. But it did nothing for us. It hurt us.
So how many times have you seen claims that went through that you developed because as you moved up in the office, you started out, you know, processing the stuff right out of the mailroom, and then you went to, you were a raider, correct?
Well, I went from claims assistant when I got hired. I was like a GS-6, really low pay position. But they get a lot of responsibility, and they're not thanks for a lot of those. That's where we pick up our disabled veterans first, and then we see where they're at, or they see where they're at. Anyways, I met other qualifications for the veteran service representative, and a couple positions came open, so a couple of us applied, and we got the position. We were able to advance. Other people were passed over for other reasons, external hires and stuff, but I was able to go from a veteran service representative after that for 7-8 months in triage, the mailroom area, to a rating veteran service representative because I have a legal background and also an English major, so I was able to transfer over to that. Plus, I've been working my own claim for the last 20 years. Go figure.
So you had to go to work at the VA to process your own claim.
I swear to you, and every veteran right now out there will tell you, we don't know what benefits are out there or how to apply for them until somebody tells us, because it's so cluttered, so convoluted. It should be so much more simple. And when we go to school, it's so simple. But when we get back, they make it so convoluted again. And it's sad. It's sad. claims are being held up, things aren't being processed right. And you know what? If they don't get it right, the veteran's always got an appeal process. I've been through the appeal process for the last 6 years. I'm up the U.S. Court of Appeals for my own claim right now. It is unsatisfactory. We should get it right the first time. Get it right the first time.
And how many times have you seen a claim that you developed, you knew all the evidence, it went all the way through, and it leaves your desk, and it goes through a decision review process, and then, you know, it continues on. How many times have you seen those claims come back?
I see them a lot, and it's sad because you see the person, and you look at it, and you're like, no way, this person's going to come back because of X, Y, and Z. We need to get certain evidence. Call the veteran. Sometimes we can't get a hold of veterans. I get that. But why can't we delay the claim another month or two and try to get a hold of the veteran or try to find another address or something or get a hold of them at the hospital? Because most of them, if they're being seen regularly, they're going to be seen at the hospital within a month. Put a note in there. Tell them we got to talk to them. Tell them we need something and then process the claim. But why process it knowing that they're going to have to come back and appeal it and drag us through the whole thing again? Because that's going to slow down our production again, because now we're working a claim that we should have got right the first time. The veterans have the money. They have to appeal it. And if they don't get it in a certain time, then they're going to be penalized. It's sad. Sad.
Well, sad. And then how many of them go through that actually have all the evidence? Everything's there. You're like, okay, this one's ready to go. And then all of a sudden, months later, it shows up again as a new claim.
Well, let me explain something to you. And there's something that they do is brokering, and it's sad. They can broker and help us out, but they choose to broker and hurt us as a station, I guess. Because what happens is you get claims, and they get orders from wherever, central office, western area, whoever, and they tell them to broker a certain amount of claims. Well, instead of picking new claims that haven't been worked and employees aren't relying on for the production or things we've already been working or actively working, they go after our claims. They pull those claims out, even though we're almost done. I've had claims that I've rated and were ready for decision, ready to award the person. They deleted my information and sent out to another station so they can get their brokering numbers. Now, that delays the claim, not months, 2 months, 3 months. It depends on when that brokering station can look at that claim again. That's unsatisfactory. That claim could have been done if they would have just mentored and reviewed it, vice brokering it out. And it still happened. Last week, I was complaining about this.
Wow. And so how disheartening. I mean, you're actually trying to do your job. Meanwhile, everything that you hear in the media, and kind of we haven't actually been helping that, is Oakland sucks, and they're doing a terrible job, and these guys are idiots. The veterans are all upset. You get phone calls. And
from April 2012, we were getting bashed as employees, and that's where the management was pinning on us. Even executive management, which is sad, telling us the employees are incompetent, they don't know they're trained. Well, guess what? We're not getting properly trained. And when we tell them we need training and additional training, I've got emails among emails for the last 2 years from the time I got back from Rating Veteran Service Representative School for 12 weeks in Seattle, stating there's deficiencies in my training, and other people have too, and they still haven't been filled. We ask questions at the trainings, and they put them in a question parking lot. Well, that question parking lot's turned into a question garage, and we still haven't got the answers for those things that are affecting each claim we work every day. It's not prompt. We don't get responses like we're supposed to. And then we're trying to make decisions based on the information we have. And when we try to go ask questions, I've been stopped. I'm trying to ask questions of people that are more knowledgeable than me so I can get the answer, so I can get the claim done. Why? Because I need to request permission to go get that question answered. Are you kidding me?
I've been told that it's sort of a divide and conquer setup, you know, where everybody is kept a little bit in the dark from everybody else. And so once a claim leaves your desk, even if you feel like it's on track and off it goes, sometimes a year later it'll come back through again, missing all of its evidence, and it's right back to square one.
Yeah, you know, there's times that we've seen that, and there's times that some of us veterans have, and even civilians, there's some really good civilians that have worked there. I don't want to forget them. But there's some good veterans and civilians that are working there that will take that claim, and they'll take ownership, and they'll try to get that claim left all the way through, especially when we see hardship or financial problems. We really don't care what the management tells us, and that's what's getting us in trouble, because we want to do what's right. I don't care about their numbers. I don't care about their bonuses they're going to get for us not getting our claims done. I want to make sure that we do what's right for the veterans. And some of us, there's a lot of other people there that will just say nothing to management and do what's right for the veterans and get in trouble later on.
Yeah, and that's awesome because they're... Okay, now, just, you know, I think we all sort of know the answer, but we don't know the official answer. What exactly is the mission of the Oakland regional office, these regional offices? What is their, in a perfect world, if they were to set up a parade for the regional offices of the VA, what is it they do?
Well, what they should be doing is providing services and benefits to veterans, and every time we provide, like, a discrepancy or a concern, they're supposed to be making decisions based on the efficiency of service, helping more veterans, helping veterans process claims correctly the right the first time. They have this thing called ICARE, I-C-A-R-E. You guys can look it up. Integrity, compassion, advocacy, respect. I can't remember the E because I never get to that part. They don't even have the first part.
Can the word imaginary start with E? No, I guess not.
No.
I was thinking Alice.
Alice in Wonderland. I know. I was like, E.
Blows me away. I was in the Marine Corps, and it didn't happen this way. And some of the civilians tried to give a point of reference, like, this is how it is in the military. I look at them like, really? You were never in the military? I was in the Marine Corps, active duty 9 years. Every day I woke up, I lived Marine Corps. This is not how it was. We don't treat our Marines like this.
Well, you can't treat citizens like this. I mean, it's different. You know, you got the NSA out there spying on everybody, and that's fine if you're, you know, in another country. I mean, I think they do have a job to do to keep apprised of what's going on, but you can't do that to U.S. citizens. We have rights, and they just look the other way. They don't even care. There's nothing's being done about
it. Like a constitution. There's a constitution. I thought.
Oh yeah, that.
Man, that always really gets us, muddies
that
the water
always
there.
Gets us into
Don't
deep,
even
deep
bring
water.
That up.
I had a pointless conversation with a guy from Berkeley the other day who called me who wanted to explain to me we needed to update it. It's like, okay, I'm going to hang up now because I'm not going to live forever and I can't waste any more time with you. So yeah, we're not tolerant of that shifting sand constitution here. So Tony, at the end of the day, if you were going to wave a magic wand, because, you know, I always like to go for the realistic solution. So if you were going to wave a magic wand on this thing and you were going to fix it and get the claims adjudicated properly so our veterans were getting the proper benefits and stop being homeless and you know, all that jazz, what would you do? What would be the first thing you would do?
Be more of an advocate. Like I said, a lot of veterans don't know what's going on. Have them come down to the VA. Have them come down to the federal office. Go out there and meet them at the vet centers. Have people in place to where they can not only take claims, but answer questions and be able to answer them exactly what the veteran needs. So we can get those claims processed. Take the statement. Get it going. Stop delaying the claims. As soon as we can get that off the books and we get it the right way, we won't see it again. The veterans are going to be taken care of. They're going to be taken care of until something else happens. I mean, God forbid.
So what fixes
that's
that?
What, I do first.
What fixes that in Oakland? If you were going to,
what
if you were in charge
Oakland,
of Oakland,
have people come down there and have talks and talk to them. Have them come in. What's your problem? Walk-ins. Do like once a month. Have a bunch of staff committed to taking in walk-ins all of a sudden, and have them tell them, come in, walk in. We'll talk to you. We'll explain what's going on, what you're missing, what you need, what we got to do to get this done.
Well, the bottom line on these claims, I mean, let's face it, they're just not that complicated.
They're kind of complicated.
Well, some of them are a little bit complicated, but either you were or you weren't injured in the line of duty, and if you were, let's get this thing rolling, because, I mean, we owe that to the veterans. It's
absolutely
not.
And if
why make this
a, but answer the question.
There's no reason why it takes years and years to process a claim. I mean, that's just wrong.
Tell me this, Tony. Well, you were developing claims, because we hear this all the time. I mean, like that fire in St. Louis that supposedly destroyed records. Well, that fire was really intermittent, and it seems to have affected things over a really wide period of time.
Yeah, what happened is there's a certain portion of the records that were destroyed. There's an alphabetical, there's a list, actually, you can find out online from the, I can't remember the manual reference right now, but it's the M21 is what we call it. I'll have to give you the reference for that one for online. But there's stuff that you have to get, and there's requirements to justify us using a fire records development clause. And there's different things you have to do to develop for that, to answer the questions, to try to draw that link. Like the other gentleman was saying, you know, we got to get the in-service event, current condition that's going on, disability, and we have to get a nexus, which is a medical thing. And those three things, and we're good. But the problem is, a lot of times we don't have the evidence that we need because there's a delay in release, or, you know, right now there's such a huge backlog. There's so many claims going on. It's so disorganized. They don't know what claims are working. We're working earlier ones, we're working later ones. There's not a real set way to get out of this. And I know central office is doing the best they can, but they should be managing the individual regional offices. The individual regional offices should be managing them based on our workload and the people that they have, because when you're San Francisco 49ers, you're not run by the main office guy. You're run by the coach, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, I think a lot of that workload is created by them. I mean, when you have to run a claim through 15 times, you know, get
exactly.
it approved.
And then we're stuck in appeals, and then you're pulling your people off the floor.
And you have the same people looking at the same claims over and over and over again. It's ridiculous.
Well, when you go
to write the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you go to process a claim and you request medical records and things like that, why is it that, because you hear this all the time from veterans, that if they don't provide the records themselves, supposedly they don't exist?
Well, the thing is that there's certain requirements by law that we have for each record. A federal record, as the VA, we have to keep going after them until they give us a negative response. Until recently, where they're saying that they're changing the clause on that. Saying that we can get one or two negative responses and then we can go forward with deciding the claim, but that's not right because the veterans that don't have that negative reply or like reservist records, if you can't get the reservist records, it's kind of hard to go forward with the service treatment records and stuff like that. And a lot of times when they're deployed back and forth, those records are flying back and forth. There's a delay there. We should wait for us to get those records back. But when we have something like the fire-related or somebody that they maybe a retirement record because they haven't been active for a while, those records are going to take a little longer to get a hold of. But for us to say, oh, we're going to do our first request in 30 days, next one in 15 days, and then that's it, we're going to go forward and make the decisions, well, that's not right because a veteran could be entitled to an exam, could be entitled to benefits. Why are we going to go forward? That's not an appropriate procedure.
Well, we hear from people all the time that they sent in. I could think of one lady right now. She sent in all of her information, and they continued to ask her for that information over and over and over over a period of years. So is it just a delay tactic? Or do they
you see the same mail over and over, and you ask them, what's going on? Why is it being delayed? And a lot of us don't see exactly what's going on, but I know that there's things where I've seen people bring claims over to other people and say, this needs to be decided today. I've told a couple people to tell me, like the managers, no, because it's not ready. It'll hurt the veteran. And they brought it to somebody else.
Oh, and made them decide it today so they could deny it, and then...
Exactly. Just like the provisional ratings we had earlier this year.
Yeah.
Those provisional ratings were to get all everybody to quiet down. They did nothing but shift inventory. All those people that didn't get their... Like, our quality went down, actually. You can check those on national numbers. Our quality went down from 90-something percent down to 80-something percent because they weren't decided based on the facts of the evidence of the case. And even that VBMS system we got right now, there's like 15,000 unassociated documents in some general file for the national database. That means that each one of those little documents could be a claim, could be the reason why a denial or acceptance is. We should be going after that first. Why are we trying to decide claims without getting that stuff cleared up? Because those could be evidence that we need for that claim to decide and get the right benefit the right first time. Why are we avoiding that? Because we want to shift inventory?
Yeah, and make it look,
like we're doing it.
Yeah, make it look more current. All right, we're going to take
Then they get bonuses, Aaron. You know that, right? That's
yeah.
How they get their stuff.
Oh, we're not going to leave that bonus topic out. We're coming back on bonuses. Stick with us.
I haven't got one in a while.
I could hear everybody just said good, but you know, I mean, the good guy should get the bonuses. The bad guy, anyway. You know, we got all opinions on that. We'll be right back with you here in 2 minutes. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM. Our moniker here is Community Radio for the North State. I kind of like Free Fire Media, though. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Sam Stone was alone when he popped his last balloon, climbing walls while sitting in a chair. Well, he played his last request while the room smelled just like death, with an overdose hovering in the air. But life had lost its fun, and there was nothing to be done but trade his house that he bought on the GI Bill for a flag-draped casket on a local hero's hill.
That's sure words.
So, that was for one of our local veterans here, in memory of our local veteran here, who waited, They outlasted him, actually.
Yep.
He decided to wheel himself in front of a train the other night. He was tired of waiting. And he was a Vietnam-era veteran with the big boils that come from exposure to Agent Orange that the VA insisted did not happen. So anyway, there are many, many people like that. That just happened to be recent. So oftentimes those incidents go unconnected.
Unreported.
Well, you know, the death is reported, but it's not connected to, right. You know, the cause isn't connected. So, for people
like the unnecessary delay in their claim, the treatment they could use,
yeah,
that's bad. It's not connected because then they don't report it appropriately.
Well, he was homeless.
Yeah, he ended up living under a bridge.
You know, living under a bridge as an amputee with big boils from Agent Orange, and the VA continued to deny his claim, saying that he didn't have exposure to Agent Orange.
And so why wouldn't we just give him treatment then, and psychological treatment and help,
exactly.
And even provide him with...
Yeah,
anyway.
It just, I know it goes on and on and on and on. And so, you know, I guess, you know, we're not doing this show to depress people. It's a little late to bring that up, I know. But we're not doing this to depress people, but I really, really, really want people to understand. Folks that have no connection with the VA or veterans or whatever, you have to realize that a lot of our homeless population are people who served. I can think of one guy. He is a Special Forces medic who made lots of jumps, lots of problems with his back and knees and that sort of thing. The VA continues to deny him. He is late 30s, early 40s, very disabled, living in a car, and refuses to get on welfare and that.
Pride. Military pride.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this isn't what people are... this is not what the general public... Let's go back to the general public. The general public looks at our military, and they see a lot of flag waving. They see a lot of veterans organizations. They donate, probably, to lots of organizations. And yet we have this massive chunk of the population that has fallen through the cracks because the beginning step, the benefits claims part, is so broken.
Well, because they don't know what's going on, too. We have to advocate. We have to educate. In order for us to get this fully developed claim process out there, we have to advocate. We have to teach them, just like we teach our claims processors. Why would we not teach the veterans how to do this, too?
Yeah.
That's what's delaying the claims. If we would teach them and help them and tell them what they need, X, Y, and Z, even though they think that they are, they're not. It's not really, I mean, come on, business models, we can go down the road that.
Yeah, and I just had somebody here in the studio say, well, I let my claim drop. I had diabetes that
you know
was developed through service, Aaron? And I'm like, no, go back.
Aaron, I would like to know how many veterans dropped their claims because of this. A lot of people in Social Security drop their claims first time because it's kind of like expected you're going to get denied first time. I heard an electronic thing denies you the first time automatically, and then you have to go and apply again. I swear, it's kind of like that with the veterans sometimes because you should always reapply, especially if you're entitled to the benefits, but a lot of them drop their claims right off the bat. And sometimes it's not even substantiated because we don't have the evidence, just like the VUS claims with all the documents that are unassociated to the claims. Are you kidding me? Those are veterans' submissions, possibly claims, additional evidence that could be denying their claims, and now they're going to drop their claim. That evidence gets to the file. Are we going to review it? We're supposed to.
And I know that people are getting called. I know veterans are being phoned now. Another one of the little scams that's going on is to call them and tell them that their claim would be processed faster if they would just reapply.
Yeah, because then they lose their date of claim. If you reapply, you lose your date of claim unless it's continually prosecuted, which means you can't have a break in your prosecution of your claim more than 1 year.
And
if you have more than 1 year of asking about my claim or submitting some type of thing, you lose your date of claim, which means they can't pay you benefits back to the date that you first originally applied unless you claim a clear and unmistakable error, which is a cue.
But they don't tell
them. I didn't know about until I worked there.
Yeah, and the clear and unmistakable error, I can tell you just from personal experience, I've sent in some information on clear and unmistakable error on a case, and the VA just pretends like you didn't tell them that. And then one time I sent it in, and they actually created a different claim so they could rip the guy off on his back pay. They used my submission of clear and unmistakable error to say that that we had actually submitted another claim.
Resubmitted the claim.
Yeah, we had started a new claim, so they only owed him a few thousand bucks just for last year.
Then what you need to do is you need to get a Freedom of Information Act. You need to request a complete copy of that file before you guys start processing the claim.
Did that.
Because once you have the evidence, they're going to have the evidence that they have on file. You reference that. And then you ask them questions about what they have on file, because a clear and unmistakable error has to be exactly from the...
Did that.
We have to have it on hand, and we have to have it exactly from the Code of Federal Regulations.
Yeah, I did that. I sent them their own evidence back on their own from their own statement of case and said, hey, look, in your statement of case, this does not match Social Security Department records. These two conflict. Date-wise, and at the end of the day, what really happens out in the on the other side of the line from where you were, they ignore it. It doesn't really matter. You request if you request a full file, I'll give you one example: 35-year-old case. Request a full file, you get 500 pages. You find out 3 weeks later when the guy goes in for a compensation and pension exam that the case is 1,200 pages. So
my recommendation to veterans is request a complete copy of your file after your first one, and then after that you can request a subsequent request up to the first part. You can't keep getting complete copies of your file over and over because of the cost, but you can get the first one, and after that, from that point on, you can request your records back to that point over and over, and even specific information over and over.
What do you think about the refusal? What do you think about the refusal to give people like their medical records?
They can't. They can't refuse them. It's the Privacy Act, 1973.
Yeah, but they do.
What they do, they lose.
No, I know. I've been denied requests for administrative investigations over management stuff. They don't. The thing is, and this is sad, I say that our management is incompetent, because incompetent definition is failure to have the ability or knowledge to perform the duties in which you're filling, and they don't have that.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the bonuses. We've got 5 minutes left, so I didn't want to actually gloss over that, because that's a big, you know, just like everything else, when you have something that is this screwed up, you know, the first question is, okay, who's getting paid?
You know, that I don't have a specific knowledge on, but I've heard through gossip again, which I can't substantiate, that the manager's got bonuses for whatever they were doing, but we weren't meeting our goals, and none of us got performance awards or bonuses, so I'm not sure why they got bonuses.
Yeah, well, and the bonuses are public because they're public. I think it was Washington Post actually posted a nationwide list of all the bonuses, and some of them are in the $60,000 to $70,000 range.
How could they do that? That's a whole other VSR position. We can have another person processing claims, and they have them process one claim. Are you kidding me?
Tony, you're thinking like a normal person. That was Willie Clark, the regional manager that supervises Oakland and 10 other centers?
The one that I reported the hostile work environment harassment stuff like that too.
Yeah, the guy in
Phoenix,
Phoenix, Arizona. Yeah,
yeah.
No, his bonus over a period of I should look it up. I'm committing I guess I'm journalistic malpractice right now, but it's, I don't know, a few years, two, three years, and it was like $50,000 or $60,000. Look it up.
How is that possible? When you go to L.A. and you look at their results, our assistant director came from L.A. and they didn't have very good results. How could they be doing that? San Diego, I know, is one of the TDCs, which is like a major center that processes claims, and they go through a lot of claims, and they turn through them. I can see them getting bonuses and stuff. LA didn't get very many bonuses because they were in the same boat we are. We were being led astray. How is that possible?
I don't know. That's why we have you on, Tony. We thought you could unravel the entire mystery of this universe for us.
No, I'm still in Alice in Wonderland. I got removed from AWOL, and I got walked out of the building and my credentials taken. I don't understand. And I've been requesting whistleblower protection for 2 years.
Yeah, how does that work anyway? Let's hit that point. When you request whistleblower protection and you speak out against the corruption in a federal agency, how's that work out for you? Besides the fact you're fired now.
There's four different ways you can do it. First, Office of Inspector General, which I've done three different times. First time was in June of 2012 for that whole training thing and everything else. Abuse of authority, misuse of resources, mismanagement, all that stuff.
that I requested two other times. The next one is Office of Special Counsel, which is supposed to be advising the Office of General Counsel and the Office of Regional Counsel, which are lawyers and judges, which I told the management to go and consult with many times. And the third one is the congresspeople and senators, which I've contacted Senator Boxer and Senator Feinstein, as well as several other congresspeople, which you can see online. And then the fourth one is the media, and that's where I'm at now. I tried for 2 years to try to work through the internal system so that way the VA doesn't get screwed over and really have a bad public image. But I've lost my job now. I can't go back in the building. I can't help veterans anymore. And I'm 100% veteran being released for being sick per my doctor's orders, and I couldn't come in to fill out the necessary forms they wanted. I mean, come on, really?
Yeah. Well, the good part is Congressman LaMalfa's office is taking this up big time, and we're looking forward to hearing the results of Tony working with that office and getting some stuff done. So that will not go unnoticed at the congressional level anymore, which is nice.
Thank you.
There's a lot coming down.
I have never reported to Officer LaMalfa. Never.
Yeah. Well,
I've only reported other ones. So if I get any action, I will greatly appreciate it. I'll bow down.
You're going to get lots of action out of that office. People are excited about that. And because it's time. I mean, we have a large area. Every congressional office has about, I think it's the constituent base is 770,000, according to the redistricting. And in that, in the North State, we have a lot of veterans. And let's face it, with all these, you know, continuing wars and all this stuff, we have more and more people being injured. We have lots of PTSD, and our Vietnam era folks. Let's face it. I mean, the treatment of those people during that era was bad back then, and from the VA standpoint, it's bad now.
And we can't even address those issues because we're still dealing with the frivolous issues of people understanding their jobs and the laws, rules, and regulations that govern their position. If
exactly.
they would take care of that, we could process more claims, we could do more for the veterans, we can help them, but we can't do that. We can't do it in a timely fashion because they don't know their jobs.
Exactly. We're going to come back with Tony on the 26th of this month, so we got a short shrift with him today, but we'll be back and do some details with you on January 26th. Thanks, Tony. Looking forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you, and I'll talk to you later.
See you guys next week. WeThePeopleRadio.us is a place to get more information on this.
Thanks, everybody.
KCNR, Shasta Redding.